B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, November 4th, 2019. Back in 1974, Steeler's Wheel had a song with the lyrics, "I've got clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, and I'm stuck in the middle with you." And that song came to mind after the latest rash of tweets from our dear tweeter, the stable genius in the White House, whose ignorance and arrogance about the conditions in California, the wildfires that have plagued us for the last 3 years, and his claims that we're not properly sweeping the forests. He jabbed at Governor Gavin Newsom on Twitter, saying that he's done a terrible job of forest management. When fires rage, the governors come to the federal government. The governor comes to the federal government for help. No more decrees. Our stable genius. And so this led Gavin Newsom, the governor, to tweet back at him, "You don't believe in climate change. You are excused from this conversation." And on Friday, advancing my advocacy, and I'm not claiming that the governor listens to my podcast interviews, but after I released the conversation with Johanna Bozwa, I think that's the right way to say her name, we see the governor is threatening to take public ownership of Pacific Gas and Electric. And that is the outcome that I think is required here. We'll delve into that a little bit more. But when you hear Trump launching these tweets, it really is just idiotic. And his knowledge of California is so superficial and incomplete that he doesn't recognize the Diablo winds in the north, the Santa Ana winds in the south, the tinder dry conditions here because of climate change. And so he has these idiotic bromides of sweeping the forest, cleaning the forest floors. And Trump believes that his advice still stands, but it's Newsom's bosses, the environmentalists, demand that he ignore the idiotic comments from the emperor with no clothes. Here's another tweet. "Every year as the fires rage and California burns, it's the same thing. And then he comes to the federal government for $3 help. No more. Get your act together, governor. You don't see close to the level of burn in other states." Well, you know, we're a little different here. And to try to compare it to other states is simply irrational. And then he adds these crazy ideas about how California is mismanaging our water. "Open up the ridiculously closed water lanes coming down from the north. What the fuck are you talking about? We have a massive river system in the northern part of California, the Sacramento Delta, and all the tributaries that flow into it. And he and his cronies, the Republicans who hold on to power from the Central Valley, continue to try to divert more of that water to agriculture at the expense of the Salmon Run and other very clear environmental concerns." And Trump doesn't recognize that the Kincade Fire is not a timber fire. The Malibu Fire, the Maria Fire, none of these are originating in forest areas. And so, you know, what we talk about, the WUI, the wildland-urban interface, WUI, that's where these fires are occurring because we have expanded beyond the urban zones and we put ourselves at risk when we build homes and live in the areas on the fringe of wildlands. So Trump's idiocy is only matched by people who would be confused as leftists. I refer to them as leftish. And I'm going to single out one of the people who claims to be a friend of mine on Facebook. His name is Liam Patrick. His profile says he's from Bath, New York. He is pro-Julian Assange. Nice going, Liam. But he is a climate change denier. And he and a bunch of his followers went to town. I'm going to read some of this idiocy to you, all right? The Cali fires are manufactured, declares Mr. Patrick from New York State. They have the technology and they are using it. So here's Melissa Morgan Topham. They caused the drought with HARP, started the fires, remove and privatize the water. It's all to make people leave their wealthy West Coast properties and move somewhere else. Social engineering. Control the water. Control the people. Then Becca Sanders says, yes, direct energy weapons. Then Tim St. John says, yes, molecular dissociation. And I don't even know what that is. And Jason Linen says, check out the fires path and the railroad lines. Coincidence? We'll return to that one. DEW's directed energy weapons. That's the opinion of Babs Medina. Dews and aerosol spraying of aluminum, which vastly intensifies fires. Tim St. John is back, no doubt. Sealed indictments are coming down. Heads will roll. People will swing for their crime soon. It's coming. Well, Tim, you know things I don't. Then Harilal Solanki chimes in again. That technology is known as energy weapons. John Horan, no lie, they come from satellites, laser beams from outer space. They could make it look like an alien attack and we would fall for it. Rebecca Fusco piles on, land grabbing without buying through eminent domain. Then we get a sequence of YouTube videos, hidden secrets, water is power, Agenda 2030. And then Daniel Royals posts a map. All right? And one shows the pattern of the wildfires, and the other shows the route of the designed high-speed rail system in the Central Valley from San Francisco to L.A. And I have to tell you, this is so cartoonish. I mean, number one, the wildfires have not been occurring along the path that is intended for our high-speed rail system that's not going to be built because we don't have enough money and the feds won't cough any up to help. And the idea that the Kincade Fire or the Malibu Fire or even the one in Riverside County has any connection to the high-speed rail project is simply idiocy. That there is no rational basis for it. Now, Liam himself returns to join the conversation. The land grab is part of the larger nefarious agenda of relocating the population, rezoning the country into specific quadrants to better control us. Oh, and depopulation is another facet of the agenda. The less people, the less to control. We have no way of knowing how many people are being lost in these fires alone. The media certainly is going to tell us. Well, Liam, let me break it to you. In all of the fires in California in the month of October, not a single person died. So you keep looking for the information about the losses of human life, all right? And let me know if you find evidence that I haven't seen. Then, get this, we introduce Jeffrey Epstein. It's mainly been a distraction from those on Epstein's list. Notice there hasn't been a peep about it until today. Feds just subpoenaed 20 prison guards from the facility Epstein was held in, and then I don't have any more of that quote. Now, there is speculation here that the Malibu fire is to cover up the pedophile dungeon that has been built under the Getty Center along the 405 freeway between, Hollywood and Brentwood. Now, I've been to the Getty facility many times. There's an old Getty, the villa in Malibu, and then there is the big Getty facility that I just described. And if people know about dungeons under these buildings, you've got information that's on frequencies that are not accessible to yours truly. And get this, in the same post, the same thread, as evidence, they offer this commentary from a woman who appeared at the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors and made comments during open time. The public gets to comment. The supervisors aren't allowed to argue or respond in any way. And this is offered as some kind of meaningful testimony. Just listen to a little of this shit.
Thank you very much, Board. It's been a very long time since I've been here. This is Deborah Tavares with StopTheCrime.net.
Deborah Tavares.
I say that because there is a very significant YouTube there on Stop the Crime. And one of the reasons why I was not here for 2.5 years, I used to be a regular attendee here. But Pacific Gas and Electric was intercepted with a download of documents professing the fact that they were going to be using directed energy weapons satellite-based on Sonoma County.
Okay, so Pacific Gas and Electric, she says, emails disclose, was planning to use directed energy weapons on Sonoma County. Now, based on this information, I am calling today for the complete disarmament of Pacific Gas and Electric. They need to cough up their directed energy weapons right now. Oh, man.
That has been up on YouTube with a plan to burn up Northern California.
Yeah, if it's on YouTube, it's got to be true, right? I mean, this is...
We discovered that Pacific Gas and Electric is operated by and large by Rothschild. Rothschild owns Weather Central and also has a large hand in weather modification.
Okay. Well, I've had enough of that. But the Rothschilds, they own Weather Central. They've taken control of PG&E with directed energy weapons aimed at Sonoma County. All right, let's disarm the Rothschilds, for God's sake. So if I can return to rational thought here for a moment, Dan Zak wrote a piece published November 4th in the Washington Post where he drove through many of the areas that have been on fire in the recent days here. He talks about the Easy Fire, the one that gnawed the perimeter of the Reagan Presidential Library, which has now morphed into the Maria Fire. And this was caused by a power line. Number two, the 1800 block of North Sepulveda Boulevard, Los Angeles, on October 28th, 1:30 a.m., high winds knocked a eucalyptus branch into a power line. A couple of white flashes of electricity turned into the Getty Fire. You know, where's the dungeon with the kids who are there for... Okay. And then we have just one other example in Riverside, in the Inland Empire of California. In the first minutes of Halloween, 12:18 a.m., police identified a stolen Dodge Dart traveling on Van Buren Boulevard. The driver refused to pull over, led officers on a high-speed chase, crashed into a field, and sparked a brush fire. By dawn, the 46 fire had swallowed more than 200 acres in Yarupa Valley. So, directed energy weapons? The Rothschilds? It is just bizarre. And it makes Trump's lunacy seem somehow more reasonable. We live in bizarre times. Absolutely. So as I mentioned, Governor Newsom is putting pressure on PG&E. And I'm not taking any credit for this, but we have seen many voices raised and heard in recent days that PG&E has to be replaced. And Newsom has tried to get Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway to buy it. I discussed that with Johanna Bozua in my conversation. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that in-depth interview yet, it's available at peterbcollins.com. But on Friday, he said that, this is not his first choice. A state takeover is on the table, described as a position the governor has previously been reluctant to embrace. But here's a quote. PG&E as we know it may or may not be able to figure this out. If they cannot, we are not going to sit around and be passive. The state will prepare itself as a backup for a scenario where we do that job for them. The entire system needs to be reimagined. It's rather remarkable the state would be doing that and not the utility itself, but that's the moment we are in. Another bitter lesson of the recent wildfires and the power shutoffs conducted by utilities in the north and south parts of California is that we have learned that our cell phone carriers have no obligation to continue to provide uninterrupted service when their power is cut. Now, I can understand if a cell phone tower is in a fire zone that it's either shut down for safety reasons or it goes offline because of the conditions. But the idea that cell phone companies who had plenty of warning that PG&E was planning these power shutoffs were unprepared, and they're claiming, and their numbers are false, that, we did our best and, we deployed people to put new batteries in and to fire up generators at some of these cell sites. Well, they had months of warning. And now we learn that both the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and California regulators have no authority to require these companies to provide uninterrupted service up to the, you know, the exclusions that I just mentioned. So here's a claim from AT&T. 3% of cell sites went down during outages. 78% of sites have permanent generators that can run for 72 hours on a single fuel tank. 12% have batteries lasting a minimum of 4 hours. All I can tell you is I am an AT&T customer, and their service sucked. On the first full day of the blackout, that was a Sunday, I could not phone. I could not download a web page. I couldn't. I got one text message through to my brother 4 miles away out of 11 attempts. And we gave up. I gave up on my phone. We finally got some service back on Tuesday, the day that power was finally restored in the evening. On to other news now. In Washington today, the House impeachment investigators, as promised by Adam Schiff last week, have begun releasing witness testimony from the so-called secret interrogations to the public. So today they released the statements of Marie Yovanovitch, the former ambassador to Ukraine, and the transcript shows that she knew of attempts by Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and his allies to work with the former Ukrainian prosecutor to do things, quote, including to me. Also, Michael McKinley, a diplomat, described to investigators how he pressed top State Department officials to publicly support Yovanovitch as she was dragged through the news. McKinley spoke directly with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, but was eventually told by a department representative that he didn't want to draw undue attention to Ms. Yovanovitch. So this is a result of the resolution that was passed on party line by the House last week, and it shows the ramping up of the process. They're telling us next to expect a release of the interviews with Gordon Sondland and Kurt Volker. Sondland has been contradicted by many subsequent people who've been interviewed. And today was a day of no-shows. And I want to make a point of clarification. One of the White House lawyers who didn't show up, despite being subpoenaed to the House committees today, is John A. Eisenberg. And he spells his name J-O-H-N. And I want to separate him in your minds from the very skilled and committed lawyer John Eisenberg, who is J-O-N like Jonathan, who is based in Oakland, California. He handled the Al-Haramain case back in 2004, 2005, and has also represented detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So there are two different John Eisenbergs. The one who works for Trump declined to appear. And in his case, because they are invoking executive privilege, Eisenberg still works at the White House. And there could be a legal basis for that claim. But the other widespread claims that former staff members, including John Bolton and the former White House counsel, that they are covered by executive privilege, well, they don't work there anymore. And I think that that is a false claim. We're also learning that Alexander Vindman, who was interviewed last week, brought his concerns to Eisenberg. Vindman is one of the people who listened in at the Situation Room on the July 25th call between Trump and Zelensky of Ukraine. We now learn that Colonel Alexander Vindman has an identical twin brother, Yevgeny, who is a lawyer on the National Security Council. That's fascinating. And so it's pretty clear here that the first Vindman, Alexander, was given a direct instruction by John Eisenberg not to talk about his concerns about the phone call or the way the transcript, the memo of the call, was placed in a super secret server at the White House. So over at BuzzFeed, there is some interesting new information available from the Mueller Limited Hangout investigation. And as you may know, I have some ups and downs with my long-term friend, Jason Leopold. I value his reporting when it's based on the Freedom of Information Act. He gets actual documents and he publishes them. It is his more speculative work at BuzzFeed, where he has reported on the Russiagate narrative with anonymous sources and unseen documents, that I take issue with. So Jason is back in his zone. He forced CNN filed lawsuits as well, but BuzzFeed sued the government to force the release of notes and other documents related to the Mueller investigation. And I was anticipating some really hot stuff. But so far, they're digging through it, and the initial articles based on the released FOIA documents are pretty boring. All right, for example, Rick Gates, who is Manafort's partner, right? In a 2018 interview with Mueller's office, he told investigators that sometime after the campaign learned in June of 2016 that WikiLeaks had hacked the hacked DNC emails, Manafort had said that the hack was likely carried out by the Ukrainians, not the Russians. So Gates and Manafort appear to be the original source for Trump's continuing belief that Ukraine was the source of whatever hacking occurred and the handoff of the documents to WikiLeaks. Now, since the approved narrative of Russiagate, saying that the Russians hacked and gave that to WikiLeaks, is still unproved, I have to say that this is worthy of some investigation. But of course, it's dismissed as a conspiracy theory here because BuzzFeed embraces the official Mueller report and that whole narrative, which I find problematic. So they repeat Konstantin Kilimnik, who's described as a longtime associate of Manafort, a dual citizen of Russia and Ukraine, but they never mentioned that he was an asset, an operative of the U.S. State Department in Ukraine. Kilimnik also suggested, says BuzzFeed, that the DNC hack could have been carried out by Russian operatives in Ukraine. Now, one of the things I've argued from the get-go is that you can obscure IP addresses and you can fake them. You can make it look like, you know, you're you're in Timbuktu if you want to. And so all of these claims, it was always Russia, 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 and CrowdStrike proved it, but never actually examined the server itself. You know what I mean. It actually was the FBI that never examined that server. Let me correct myself there. At any rate, I've gone through it, and it's pretty ho-hum. I will continue to watch BuzzFeed to see if we learn more. But it's mostly tidbits, like Paul Manafort was still actively advising the campaign after he was forced to quit and right up through Election Day, that Steve Bannon told the FBI that Jared Kushner had been on vacation in Croatia in the summer of 2016, in August, and that he was accompanied by an unnamed Russian billionaire. Okay, that's interesting. Why don't you tell us who the guy is? So, at any rate, I don't call it much ado about nothing, but it's not that valuable so far. Hillary Clinton keeps getting covered every day, and it heightens speculation that she may be hoping to save us all by entering the Democratic primary for 2020 president. The latest is that she went to a screening in New York of The Great Hack. I've watched that on Netflix. It's about Cambridge Analytica. And honestly, it doesn't connect to Russia in any meaningful way. And I thought the documentary was a real disappointment. They never make the connection that it was the Trump campaign's use of the dark targeting from Cambridge Analytica, plus $82 million that the campaign spent on Facebook, that had a lot of impact, more than anything claimed and attributed to Russia. But this piece in The Guardian today really pissed me off. Hillary Clinton, she said it was inevitable that false information on Facebook would have an impact on elections because propaganda works. In 2016, she said fake news on Facebook that Pope Francis had endorsed her opponent really did have an impact, and predicted it's only going to be more powerful going forward. Now, the implication is that that was part of the Russian scheme. The claim that Pope Francis had endorsed Trump was run down by Scott Shane of the New York Times, and he proved that it was posted by a college graduate who was unemployed living near Baltimore. Had no ties to Russia whatsoever. But that Pope endorsement of Trump gets wrapped up in this whole pile of bullshit. Hillary went on to say, when Facebook is the principal source for more than half of the American people's news, the only source of news that most of them pay attention to, if it announces it has no responsibility for the airing of false ads, how are you supposed to get accurate information? Well, apparently, Mrs. Clinton is not aware that the election rules in this country allow candidates to run false ads on television. Now, there have been a few egregious cases where networks have intervened and risked lawsuits. But, by and large, that's the way it works, and it's been that way for a long time. Apparently, it's news to her. And in a separate article at The Guardian, they trot out Bob Shrum, a Democratic strategist who advised all of the losing candidates in recent history. And even he says, look, I don't think she would run again. I don't think she should. It would be late and very divisive. I'm dubious she would win the nomination, so why would she do that to herself? He added, she had the election taken from her in 16. I don't think she ran a very good campaign, but she would have won anyway if it wasn't for James Comey and Russia. So there are people who feel it would only be just if she got second bite at the apple. On the other hand, there are a lot of Democratic voters who are saying, let's move on. That's one of the problems Joe Biden is having. Well, I want to point out a couple of articles in today's New York Times. One of them by Nate Cohn is nominally about the latest polling information. And it shows that Bernie Sanders, in different matchups, beats Trump more often and by larger margins than Elizabeth Warren does. But the article is entirely framed about Warren and Trump. And Sanders is just, he gets a little mention here and there. But they basically are either excising him from the coverage or minimizing his involvement as if, you know, he's not a factor in this race. And their own polls show him in that clumped group at the top with Biden, Warren, and Buttigieg. And so it is amazing to see how the media is trying to pick the winners here. They want to see Elizabeth Warren. Similarly, another piece at the Times today talks about how worried Wall Street is that Warren's going to be the next president. And Bernie Sanders gets a little mention behind parentheses. Senator Bernie Sanders, who describes himself as a socialist, is also feared by Wall Street, but is considered less likely to capture the nomination. And so, as they continue to work to set the goalposts and the framework for this election, deciding who is acceptable and who is not, the Times is really doing a number. Beto O'Rourke announced on Friday he's dropping out. Kamala Harris of California, once in the top tier, has fallen as low as 3%, but she did manage to squeak into the November debates. And speaking of Beto, I have to say that coming off a loss in the Senate race against Ted Cruz was not a promising start to his campaign. But I don't understand why he hasn't gotten more traction. I think he is interesting, certainly more interesting than Amy Klobuchar or any of these, super moderates. And he just never got what he needed to keep a campaign going. Gatekeepers at the Times once again, in an article buried in the Sunday paper, growing criticism on left of U.S. policy on Israel. And they note a Gallup poll in February asked Democrats about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. 43% of Democrats said they were partial to Israel, the lowest number in 14 years. 30% say they sympathize with the Palestinians. Among liberal Democrats, there's almost now an even split between those saying they sympathize with the Israeli side and the Palestinian one. And this is a follow-up. I covered this on Friday as both Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg went to the J Street Conference. They're the moderate Zionists in Washington. And I explained that Mehdi Hassan at The Intercept and Miko Pellet at Mint Press News offered sharply different versions of the J Street event. This is the Times edition to that coverage. Also, I'm going to note that Max Blumenthal has yet to be covered by the corporate media. I didn't do a Google search today, but I haven't seen anything fresh on his arrest a week ago Friday. And I had hoped to record an interview with Max today, but we have been unable to confirm a time. So I am still working on that, and I hope I can get it for you in short order. Every day I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And today I want to mention a few great people like Terry Paris, who just did some house cleaning and rearranged her multiple subscriptions. Terry, I appreciate your strong commitment to the podcast. There's Billy Cook, who was a Pez machine for Halloween up in Eureka, Cheryl Fleming, and Dick Atlee in Maine. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I hope people see the example you set, that they can have their own subscription to the PBC podcast, validate the work that I do, and help pay some of the bills here. You can log on at peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, and I think you can take it from there. I'm going to run long today because I've got more news than we have room for, and I'll just leave it up to you to decide how much time you have to listen, all right? That's how it works. So we know that the intervention of the Trump White House in the congressionally approved military aid for Ukraine has produced this impeachment investigation. Why would they pile on? Well, over the weekend, we learned that Trump et al. Have frozen all military aid to the Lebanese army, including a package worth just over $100 million that was approved by the State Department and Congress in September. Now, the inference or the speculation is that the White House did this as a favor to Israel because they are demonizing Hezbollah, which has a minor role in the government in Lebanon and its own military. So I'm not really clear what is going on here. I don't understand what basis the White House has to freeze this. And it's just another example of the expansion of presidential power asserted by this guy. And Congress just doesn't fight back. I was surprised to hear this, that Boris Johnson, the conservative trying to hold on to the prime minister's job in England, announced over the weekend that he will halt fracking temporarily in the only active site in Britain in northwest England. Now, I am surprised to see this coming from an alleged conservative. The opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn tweeted that this was only a temporary pause, an election stunt. His party would ban fracking permanently. You ever hear that from a Labour Party, a Democratic Party here in the United States? No, a few members, but not the party. Tip of my hat to Olivier de Mirleau in Switzerland, who sent me an article from Axios that I hadn't seen, showing that the Democrats are outflanked on social media by Trump's operation in stunning ways. Trump has attracted three times the attention of all the Democratic candidates combined. The Democratic candidates picked up a combined 58 million social media actions or interactions during the same period that Trump got 181 million. The 1 week total for the week of October 27, Trump had 47 million interactions, Biden 2.6 million, Sanders just under 2 million, Warren 1.6 million. And so Trump has figured out how the social media platforms work, and the Democrats are trying to catch up. So they have hired David Plouffe, the smart campaign strategist who got Obama elected in 2008 and was on the campaign in 2012. He and Tara McGowan, the founder and chief executive of Acronym, say their digital campaign will kick off immediately. They are planning to raise $75 million to spend in just four states. Arizona, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. Oh, it's five. Wisconsin. That's funny because their organization is calling the campaign Four is Enough, and they're operating in five states. All right. They are going to use a dark money super PAC alongside a political action committee, which will disclose its donors. But this is a desperate effort to access corporate cash to try to compete with Trump. Now, I often, and twice today, have dinged the New York Times. But in Sunday's edition, they included a 10-page special section called the Twitter Presidency, and they have analyzed, here's the number, 11,390 presidential tweets. More than half of them are Trump attacking people, 5,889. No other category even comes close. The person he most often singles out for praise is Donald J. Trump. His use of the Twitter account has accelerated sharply. He's tweeted more than 500 times during the first 2 weeks of October as the impeachment investigation has been unveiled and is moving forward. He has 66 million Twitter followers, but get this, fewer than 20% are voting age Americans. What does that mean? 80% of them are not voting age Americans. I don't understand that data point. That shocks me. So it takes about an hour to read the whole thing, and I breezed through it last night. I do encourage you to pick it up. It is a fascinating profile of our dear tweeter. The White House is denying a claim published by a British conservative outlet called The Spectator and repeated by the Daily Mail tabloid that Jared Kushner, our crown prince, gave approval to the Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman to arrest Jamal Khashoggi. Now, that doesn't indicate that Kushner approved his execution and the bonesaw activities at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. But get this, the speculation promoted by this article is that Turkey intercepted the call between Kushner and MBS and then used it to blackmail Donald Trump into removing U.S. troops from northern Syria. Now, this is highly speculative, but since it's been denied by the White House, it could be true, and I report it for your consideration. E. Jean Carroll, who is the British would call her an agony aunt columnist. She writes an advice column for a women's magazine, Elle. And she went public back in the summer and said that Donald Trump raped her at Bergdorf Goodman, the department store. And Trump has said he never knew her, he didn't do it, she wasn't his type. That's always an interesting defense, right, to a rape allegation. Oh, well, she's not my type. You know, I would never rape her because she's not. That is just so bizarre. Anyway, she has now piled on with a defamation suit because Trump has lied about not knowing her and not raping her. Someday, she may see justice. Trump has been ordered once again to allow his accounting firm to release 8 years of his tax returns. A federal appeals panel said today that the firm has no more excuses and must turn them over. And they turned aside the arguments about the expansive claims of presidential power asserted by Trump's lawyers and said, well, look, we emphasize the narrowness of the issue before us. This appeal doesn't require us to consider whether the president is immune from indictment and prosecution while in office, nor to consider whether he may be lawfully ordered to produce documents for use in a state criminal proceeding, because the order is applied to Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA. A judge in Oregon has blocked Trump's rule requiring immigrants to prove before they can enter the United States that they have already acquired health insurance. It is a bogus hurdle placed in front of people who already have so many restrictions on their entry to the country. And finally today, I lament that while I never approved of the war in Iraq, once the U.S. went in, and once many Iraqis put their lives at risk by serving as interpreters or scouts or cooks or allowing soldiers to stay in their homes, these people deserve respect and admission to the United States, in my opinion. Only 153 Iraqi refugees whose applications were given high priority were admitted in the fiscal year that just ended at the end of September. There were 9,800 the year before. There are 110,000 on a wait list. And worldwide, there are 300,000 people actively seeking refugee status to enter the United States. But the Trump team has reduced that from Barack Obama's last year, 110,000, to 18,000 in the coming year. Here at Fortress America, the drawbridge is up, and it's going to stay that way. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast all the way to the end here. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.